As we continue our study this evening, we're going to look at some questions that we want to deal with. And as I study some of these questions, I'll be dealing with some things that I have the attitude that I don't really care which way it is as long as I know which way it is. In other words, we need to be careful in Bible study not to make up our minds this is the way we want it to be, and then we're going to do whatever it takes to make it that way. So the first question I have that I want to look at is, who were the women of verses 34 and 35? So if you would, turn in your Bibles. I think we really need to take a few moments here. And before we go on into the lesson, and we need to look at these verses here in 1 Corinthians 14. 1 Corinthians 14, I think that the sentence actually should begin in the middle of verse 33. Some translations don't do that, but I think that it is better to let the sentence begin in the middle of verse 33, as in all the churches of the saints, let the women keep silence in the churches. I believe that that is the more accurate reading. As in all the churches of the saints, let the women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but let them be in subjection, as also saith the law. And if they would learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is a shame, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in the church. So I want to raise the question here, not because I am interested in advocating it, but because it is a point to be considered. And there are those who do teach this point. So I think it is a point that needs to be considered and it needs to be evaluated. And the two points that we're going to really look at here, we will find that really either way, the outcome is the same. So the first question here, the wives of the prophets. The word translated women here in verse 34 is the word that means wives. It means wives. However, it can also mean females as opposed to just any human being. But it is the word that would be used to translate the idea of wife. It also has the article, the women, there in verse 34, in the original, not only in the English, but in the original. It has the. Therefore, there are particular women of concern here. Now, if these are the wives of the prophets, so take a moment and let that sink in. Verse 34, let the women, let the who, let the wives, let the wives of the prophets. And so some say that that's who these women are. They are the wives of the prophets. So that in a circumstance where the prophets would be speaking up, then their wives might be led to believe that, yeah, it'd be fine for them to speak up too. It would even be fine for them to interrupt their husband from the floor to ask a question. And that is dealt with here in this immediate context. So we have some women. The word could mean wives. The points out that it is some particular women, but which one? Now, this position that the women there are the wives of the prophets would clear up the question about asking their husbands at home. Because if these were the wives of the prophets, then obviously the wife would have a husband and the husband would be a prophet and the prophet would be in a very good position to answer her question that she would ask. So the position has that, that recommends it. Now, think carefully. Even if the women are particularly the wives of the prophets, let's just suppose that in verse 34, that is the background, that is the context, that these women are particularly the wives of the prophets. This really would not make any difference as far as the position of what women can do is concerned. It make really no difference. Because we needn't think that the wives of the prophets would be forbidden to do what other women could do freely. You see that? So why tell the women who, if these women in verse 34, are if these are the wives of the prophets, why emphasize, keep silence, not permitted to them to speak, let them be in subjection as also saith the law, if they would learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home. Why apply those restrictions only to the wives of the prophets and not to the other women. So I don't believe I don't think that would make any difference whether we're looking at the wives of the prophets or women in general. I think that the point would still be that they are forbidden to speak in the circumstances that we read in 1 Corinthians 14. Now, it is by no means certain that the reference here is to the wives of the prophets. It may be. But what I'm telling you is that I don't really see any difference that would make in the final outcome of the position that we take. Look at it like this. Even if it is referring to the prophets' wives, verse 34, let the women keep silence in the churches. Even if it is referring to the prophets' wives there, what we would have is a specific prohibition which only applies to certain women, wives of the prophets, based on a general rule which applies to all women without limitation. Because if you will look at it again, verse 34, let the women keep silence in the churches. Now suppose we say that is limited to that specifically applies to the wives of the prophets. What is the reason that he gives why they are not, or why they are to keep silence? The reason, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but let them be in subjection as also saith the law. Now, any reference to what the law would say on that was certainly not limited to just the wives of the prophets. It would have been addressed to women in general. Whatever the law of Moses had to say on this subject would not have been limited only to the wives of the prophets. So that the point is being made here, there is a general reason, a reason that applies to all women, and that reason is being applied specifically to why the women, the wives of the prophets, are to keep silence. And so I say again, I'm not advocating that position, but what I'm saying is that I don't really see any difference in the long run that it would make, because if that were the case, we'd have a specific prohibition here, but it would be based on a general prohibition that applies, or a general rule which applies to all women without limitation. Now, let's consider the idea that this is just to women generally. And the main question that is raised when we want to know, is verse 34 just saying women in general? The main question raised here is, how could it include all women when all women would not necessarily have husbands to ask at home? I don't consider that to be a very substantial question. But still, it is a question that would be raised, and we need to seek for an answer. Another objection would be, plus a lot of women would have husbands who know far less about the Bible than their wives. Well, then hopefully if that were the case, she wouldn't need to ask the question. You know, I mean, if she's that good a Bible student, maybe she wouldn't need to ask the question. The word translated husband is also the word used when one wishes to refer to a male. Now, let me make sure that in verse 35, I want you to know what I'm talking about here. And if they would learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home. Now, that's the verse we're looking at here. That's where these questions arise. If it's not a wife of the prophet, suppose it's a woman without a husband, how can she ask her husband at home? If it is a woman who knows more about the Bible than her husband, then how could she ask her husband about this? How could that be? The point I'm making here is that that word translated husband is a word that is used for husband. But it is also a word that is used when you're wanting to talk about a male. You're specifying a male instead of just a human being in general. And so if that were the case, it could mean let the women ask their men at home, whatever man it might be. It might not be the husband, but it might be a father. It might be someone else. And so this statement, let them ask their men at home, let them ask their husband at home, is a general rule that in practice would have to be applied with suitable judgment in specific situations. And so I don't see that as being a fatal objection to the idea that this is to women in general in verse 34. Let the women in general. So what we've done here is we've looked at two possible explanations of the women in verse 34. Let the women keep silence. We've looked at the idea that it could be the wives of the prophets. But if it is the wives of the prophets, the reason why they are told to keep silence is because of a general rule that applies to all women. If the term is a reference in verse 34 to all women, then the objections that are raised against it are really not very heavy. And so you have these two. But the result is the same thing. One of the things that we have to remember any time you're studying a controversial point is don't get so bogged down and so hung up on some of the fine points that you neglect to remember the overall lesson that's being made. And I think that that's something we really do need to emphasize, and I'm going to continue to emphasize that as we move along through the study. Now, another question. Was 1 Corinthians 11 written with the idea of permitting a woman to prophesy to the whole church as long as she wore a covering? And I'm not going to study that in depth. I'm just going to refer to the fact that in 1 Corinthians 11:5, Paul writes, "But every woman praying or prophesying with her head unveiled dishonoreth her head, for it is one and the same thing as if she were shaven." And so making the point that if the woman is going to prophesy or pray, she needs to have her head covered. So the question is, was it written with the idea of permitting a woman back in this day? We don't even have to say now. We can say back in that day, in the context of this letter, in the context of the church at Corinth, was Paul saying in 1 Corinthians 11 that if a woman is going to prophesy to the whole assembly, let her wear a covering? And then in 1 Corinthians 14, specifically say, she can't do that. And I think that the answer is no. That 1 Corinthians 11 was not written. I do not believe that it was written with the idea of permitting a woman to prophesy to the whole church, to the whole church come together as long as she wore a covering. So I do not believe there is authority here for a woman to preach to the whole church, even if she is inspired, even if she does wear a covering. Having written 1 Corinthians 11, we remember this is Paul. We don't have two different letters by two different authors. This is the same letter, and within the same letter, having written 1 Corinthians 11, Paul still says here in 1 Corinthians 14 that a woman cannot do the very thing to the whole church that the prophets can do, and that is prophesy. So I don't see any way that 1 Corinthians 11 could be looked upon as an exception so that the woman, if she wore the covering, could prophesy to the whole assembly. I do not believe that the woman had the permission or the right to preach to the whole assembly under any circumstances. And so it would by no means necessarily be implied that 1 Corinthians 11 would permit a woman to prophesy to the whole church. There are other situations in which a woman could prophesy that would not involve the whole church, such as a class of women, a class of children, and so on. Now, here's another question. Since chapter 14, verses 33 through 35, is a chapter dealing with tongue speaking and prophesying, why would it apply today, since these miracles have ceased? And that's a question that is often asked about 1 Corinthians 11 as well as 1 Corinthians 14 and these restrictions that are placed upon the women. Now, the prohibition of 14:33 through 35, let your women keep silence in the church, in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but let them be in subjection as also saith the law. And if they would learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in the church. The prohibition of chapter 14, verses 33 through 35 is not limited to tongue speaking and prophesying. It is not permitted, it is general. It is not permitted unto them to speak, but to be in subjection, as also saith the law. Now, once again, we have that, we refer to that point, as also saith the law. Do you think you can go back into the law and find where the law distinguished between whether this was miraculous prophesying, whether it was not, and all that? No, what the law said would be general to all women. If we refer to Genesis 3 and verse 16, where Eve was put in subjection to Adam, Now, what limitation could you put on that? Why would that not apply to all women, regardless of whether they were prophesying or whether they were not? And bear in mind that if you say, well, what if they were prophesying? Well, that's the specific point Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 14. They can't do that to the whole assembly. They can't do that to the whole assembly. So the language that is here being spoken of, especially the background, reasons, are not related to its being miraculous. It is related to the role of the woman. See, the reasons why she's to speak or not to speak has nothing to do with the fact she's inspired. It has to do with the role of the woman. And the role of the woman is appointed of God long before the first century. The speaking of verse 34, once again, let the women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak. The speaking of verse 34, therefore, refers to instructional speaking to the whole assembly. But it must also be defined by the setting, which is in the church. It even applied to the asking of questions in the whole assembly, or in the public assembly. Because verse 35 says, and if they, the women in the context, and if they would learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home. For it is shameful for a woman to speak in the church. I think that the clear and necessary implication of that verse is that the women could learn by asking their husbands and interrupting. They could interrupt. But he says, do not do that. If the women would learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home. Why? For it is shameful for a woman to speak in the church. Again, the reasons that are given are general. They are very general. They are not related to a specific time, or just the idea of miracles. It is not related to that. All right, what about women making announcements, leading singing, speaking out in the assemblies? All right, I have a point I want you to consider here. You could add some other things possibly here. We're not going to be able to take the time to go into all of these. But I want you to consider this point, which I consider to be a very interesting, not just interesting, it is a vital point to consider. Because in the midst of this controversy, and in the midst of what many are saying, the fact is that if we were to grant that, okay, women can make announcements, they can lead singing, they can speak out in the assemblies of the whole church, if we granted that and said, yeah, we're going to start doing that, I am 100% convinced that this would not satisfy what I believe is the objective of the Crusaders for more active roles for women. This is not where they're going. They will use this as a paving stone to get to where they want to go, which is to have women freely able to preach from the pulpit as men are. That it will be just as good for women to be elders as it is for men. I believe that is ultimately where they want to go with this. And so merely granting some of these things on the way, that would not actually satisfy. It would just be a stepping stone. They will not be satisfied until women are preaching in the pulpit. And I believe that that is the spirit that is at work here. The truth is, in application of the matter of making announcements, leading singing, and so on, in all activities of the local church, the women are not to speak, but to be in subjection, as also saith the law. Rather than being in a role of leadership in the affairs of the Lord in the local church, the woman is to be in subjection, as also saith the law. Now, I said a good bit this morning about the fact that this does not reflect my personal thinking. My personal thinking is based upon what God says. I have to accept what God says. I want to accept what God says. It is not a matter of seeking to put women down or to keep women from rising to their full potential or anything like that. That it has nothing to do with that. It is a matter of respecting God and respecting His Word. Now, in 1 Timothy chapter 2, we want to turn to that passage and give it some attention as well. This is the other passage that we're going to be giving attention to. 1 Timothy 2, verses 11. I'm going to read verses 11 through 15. Let a woman learn in quietness with all subjection. But I permit not a woman to teach, nor to have dominion over a man, but to be in quietness. For Adam was first formed, then Eve. And Adam was not beguiled, but the woman being beguiled hath fallen into transgression. But she shall be saved through her childbearing, if they continue in faith and love and sanctification with sobriety. So let's look at this passage now. Let a woman learn in quietness with all subjection. This is rooted and grounded in Genesis in the account of the creation. That's verses 13 and 14 right here. I'm talking about 1 Timothy 2, verses 13 and 14. I believe that a very significant point here is note the context between the men in chapter 2 and verse 8 and the woman in chapter 2 and verse 11. In verse 8, Paul writes, I desire, therefore, that the men pray in every place, lifting up holy hands without wrath and disputing. So there is no limitation on where a man may do this. But verse 11, let a woman learn in quietness with all subjection. There is where the limitation is. So the very fact that the men are to pray in every place means there is no limitation placed on where it is proper for a man to perform the role of praying. But for a woman to do that, she is restricted. She is to learn in quietness with all subjection. So rather than the woman being a teacher of men, she is to learn in quietness with all subjection. This contrast is seen clearly in verse 12. The woman is not to teach, nor to usurp authority over a man, but to be in quietness. Now, what is this quietness that is here? It is the Greek word, heisoukia. And Thayer defines this word, quietness. I have to tell you that always amuses me, and I've had that happen so many times. You know, you go to Thayer, boy, he's going to really open the light. And the first word he gives is exactly the word that you find in your Bible. So that's one thing for you to remember. Greek is of limited value. Thayer defines this word as meaning quietness, descriptive of the life of one who stays at home doing his own work and does not officiously meddle with the affairs of others. And the reference Thayer gives there, 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 12, where Paul is warning and admonishing the Thessalonians that they are not to be busybodies. They are not to meddle in other men's affairs and so on. So this is the definition that Thayer gives here. Second definition, silence. And under silence, he quotes 1 Timothy 2:11. So that in the definition that Thayer gives, he is contrasting the public role that men can serve, praying in every place, lifting up holy hands without wrath and disputing, to the idea that the woman is to be silent in contrast to the man. Now, the context must be noted. There is the contrast between the public role of men and the non-public role of women. And the teaching is defined by the context as public teaching. In other words, unrestricted. Anyone can come. Men can do that teaching. The women cannot. They are restricted. They are to learn in silence. The man can do that kind of activity. The woman cannot. In other words, the quietness here would not prohibit women from teaching other women. It would not prohibit them from teaching children. There would be much teaching and valuable teaching that they could do. The idea of a woman teaching a man privately in the sense of imparting information is not specifically dealt with in this passage. So what if that were to happen? Well, I think that if a man and a woman were talking, the woman imparted information to the man in a private conversation, that would have nothing to do with this situation. I do not believe there would be anything at all amiss in a circumstance like that. But here you've got that contrast again in the context between the men praying in every place, unrestricted, whereas the woman is to be in quietness, she is to learn in quietness with all subjection. And so that situation between just a man and a woman talking in private is not dealt with in this context. Now, I use the expression imparting information because that is a general definition of teaching. And Paul says, I do not permit a woman to teach nor to have dominion over a man. So we need to focus on that. That's verse 12. We want to focus particularly on verse 12. Teach in this passage, I permit not a woman to teach, is from the most common Greek word to teach in the New Testament. Usurp authority or to have dominion over is from a different word, authentain. Defined by Thayer as to govern one, to govern one, to exercise dominion over one. It had an earlier usage of one who acts on his own authority, autocratic, which certainly seems to fit this context. Now, grammatically, one cannot apply over to teach. And I will explain why. And once again, I want you to see that if you look at the English of verse 12, I permit not a woman to teach nor to have dominion over a man. Now, sometimes people say, well, teach over. Well, they're doing that because in our English, over is a separate word in the verse. But in the original language, the over is a part of that authentain that I told you about. It does not inhere in the idea of teaching. But it is in this idea of to usurp authority, to have dominion over. So the over is a part of that verb itself, and it is not necessarily a part of the verb to teach. So I just want you to understand that. I've heard that said, and you can't really say it like that, to say about teaching over and applying over to teach. Over is a part of the verb for the other word. It belongs to the word to have dominion over. Nevertheless, but here is the rub. The context contrasting the public role of man and the private role of the woman defines the teaching that a woman cannot do as a kind of teaching in which a man or men are in subjection to her, as if she is the head of the class. She is presiding over the class. She is presiding over the auditorium. She could not do that kind of teaching. So the context defines what kind of teaching when Paul says, I permit not a woman to teach. Well, he's certainly not saying just, you know, that's it. No teaching at all. But the context defines it as a kind of a teaching in which a man or men would be subject or in subjection to her. Circumstances that would violate this principle would be for a woman to preach to an assembly of men, for her to teach a class of men, for her to preach to the whole church. Now focus on the reasons why God says and why Paul writes that this is the way it is to be. Adam was first formed, then Eve. What I want you to see here is that these reasons are not merely temporal reasons. These are reasons rooted in the very deepest part of the Bible, the very earliest part of God's dealings with men. Adam was first formed, then Eve. Adam was not beguiled, but the woman was. And here I always feel like I need to say this, because sometimes there are some foolish men who say, see, you women were beguiled, see, and we weren't beguiled. Well, that's nothing to brag about, because that meant that Adam did it knowing it was wrong. You see? So that's not exactly anything to brag about. This is just reported by Paul as a fact, and it was a fact that God considered when woman led the way, she led Adam into evil. Now, Adam had responsibility also, heavy responsibility in going along with that. But he makes the point, this is one of the reasons why he has ordained the relationship of the man and the woman to be as it is. Adam was not beguiled, but the woman being beguiled hath fallen into transgression. Note further reasons for the woman's subjection to man given in 1 Corinthians 11. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Eve was made from Adam. Adam was not made from Eve. Secondly, man was not created for the woman, but the woman for the man. And so, again, these reasons are showing us that this is not something just true in the first century. Do these facts change with the passing of time? And the answer is no, they do not change with the passing of time. And so the things that are said in these passages, primarily 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Timothy 2, but also 1 Corinthians 11 with regard to headship, these things do not change with the passing of time. Now the feminists and humanists try to say this was just a first century thing. None of the reasons that we have looked at here in 1 Timothy 2, or 1 Corinthians 14, or 1 Corinthians 11, have anything that pertain exclusively to the first century. You notice I have here this reference to 1 Peter, which I think is very significant. In 1 Peter 3, verses 5 and 6, Peter says, "For after this manner aforetime, the holy women also, who hoped in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose children ye now are, if ye do well, and are not put in fear by any terror." When did that happen? What Peter wrote about there, how far back does that go? Why, that goes back 2,000 years. That goes back to the days of Abraham. So again, do we have something here limited to the first century? And the evidence is absolutely not. The things that Paul is using as the grounds of what he is teaching are not things that were limited by any means to the first century. Or these same people will say that Paul was a woman hater, and so forth. If you accept that, then we throw out Paul's inspiration. And if we throw out his inspiration on that, we throw out his inspiration on salvation, the sacrifice of Jesus, redemption. We throw it all out. And if we throw Paul's inspiration out, we throw Peter's inspiration out. And we'll wind up, you can't throw out any of it without throwing out all of it. If we're going to do only what we like anyway, we don't need the Bible at all. And that is what a lot of people have decided. And we have to decide how we feel about that. And I can understand feminists and humanists taking these views because of their background, because of their presuppositions. But what I find hard to understand is why people who are claiming to be Christians take these same views. And I believe that they share much more in common with the feminists and humanists than they would like to admit. "She shall be saved through her childbearing," or through the childbearing, 1 Timothy 2:15. Does this statement mean that the woman is going to be saved through the mere physical act of bearing a child? If that is the case, then Jezebel made it. Would you be willing to grant that Jezebel made it, or that Athaliah made it? Hardly. It is an untenable position, inconsistent with other passages, far too many problems. The New Testament teaches that far more is involved in salvation than just the literal act of bearing a child. Surely we can see that without much argument. The childbearing here denotes the realm of the primary activity of the woman, as does workers at home in Titus 2:4, as is stated also in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 10. This is the chief domain of the woman. She is to rule the household, 1 Timothy 5:14, meaning that she is in charge of the operation of the household, just like that worthy woman of Proverbs 31 was. Now, we're nearly through. You know, I like to tell an audience occasionally that, because you may begin to get nervous, well, we're almost through. But I think you're going to find this part a very significant part. When Paul says, "As also saith the law," I want to delve into that a little bit more fully. We've already mentioned the statement made in Genesis 3:16 where God made Eve subject, her desire subject unto her husband. But there are some other things that I want us to look at briefly. And so Eve was definitely placed in subjection to Adam as a result of the first sin, Genesis 3 and verse 16. Fact. That is a divine historical fact. As Peter points out, Sarah was in subjection to Abraham, Genesis 18 and verse 12, is the reference that Peter is referring to in 1 Peter 3, verses 5 and 6. Miriam did not lead Israel, even though she would like to have done so. We can all remember that. I told about that story this morning. There were no women priests. Now, here I want to take a moment, because today, you know, we'll sometimes have a little girl who will say, and I can understand why a little girl would say this, "Mama, why don't I get to do so and so?" I can understand that. I can understand why a little girl would want to ask that question. And when she asked that question, her mother needs to explain to her reverently exactly what the Bible teaches. You don't have to go into great depth. Depending on the age of the child, you can tell the child. But do you think that back during the days when Aaron and Eleazar and Phinehas and the high priest succession continued like that, and the men from the tribe of Levi, the family of Aaron, were being the priest, do you think there was never any occasion when some little girl among the Israelites asked her mom, "Why can't I be a priest?" Do you think that probably did not happen? I have no doubt it did happen. When it did happen, what do you think that the mother in Israel would tell her daughter? Even more, I ask you, if you were a mother in Israel and your daughter asked you that, what would you have told her? I believe and hope that you would have told her that it is God's choice and God's appointment that the men be priests, and would have helped her daughter to understand that, and to understand that it wasn't that God had it in for women. It wasn't that Moses had it in for women. But in the arrangement that God has ordained between men and women, God is helping us to remember certain important facts that happened at the dawn of the world. And the things that He has appointed in the relationship between the man and the woman are things that are to remind us of the things that happened at the beginning. So there were no woman priests. Now Deborah was a judge. Here we're going to look at a comparison very quickly. We all know about Deborah. Deborah was a judge. And Deborah was identified in terms of her husband, Lapidoth. Who is Deborah? She was the wife of Lapidoth. Now that was not just an accidental thing, because we're going to see another case where the woman was identified in terms of her husband. So the Scriptures identified Deborah in terms of her husband, Lapidoth. And we don't know another thing about Lapidoth. But he had one fine wife, I'll tell you that. And contrast her work in judging with the people coming to her at her house. Judges 4 and verse 5 specifically says that Israel came to her house to be judged. Instead of her going out and riding a circuit, she did not go out from city to city throughout Israel. On the other hand, Samuel, in 1 Samuel 7, verses 15 through 17, is said to have gone from Ramah to Mizpah to Geba, and, you know, he went about from city to city, several cities there, and he would go from one to the other in a very public role. Deborah did not. I believe that this contrast is part of the teaching that we see in the Old Testament on this subject. Deborah called Barak to lead the army and thought it amiss that he would demand that she accompany the army. Now, Deborah did not at all consider, "Well, here, hey, I'm the judge, I'll lead the army. Why can't I lead the army?" No, Deborah did not for one moment consider leading the army. Why? Because she was a woman. And she knew that God did not want her to do that. And when Barak insisted that she accompany the army, she definitely thought it amiss. And God thought it amiss because through Deborah, He inspired her to say, "Because you have done this, Barak, the glory will be given into the hand of a woman and not you." The only woman to rule in Israel was a usurper named Athaliah. 2 Kings 11. Now the other comparison, hold to the prophetess. Hold to the prophetess. Now she was a prophetess in the days of Josiah, also in the days of Jeremiah. She is identified as the wife of Shallum. So again, this is a significant thing, that even though these were women who were prominent in their way and in their day, they were identified in terms of their husband. She was a prophetess in the days of Josiah, and she spoke to men who came to her house to ask her what Josiah wanted her to be asked. There was no doubt on the part of any one of them that she was a prophetess and that she was inspired of God. Nobody had any doubt of that. But they came to her house and asked her what Josiah wanted. Contrast her mode of work with that of Jeremiah, a contemporary of hers, in Jeremiah 7, 1 and 2, when God tells him, go down to the temple and preach to the people that come. So here Huldah's work was private. Jeremiah's work was to be done publicly. Deborah's work was done privately. Samuel's work was done publicly. What's the difference? Deborah and Huldah were women. And Samuel and Jeremiah were men. And they were observing the restrictions that God has placed upon women. And so here are some conclusions, quickly and briefly stated. Women cannot preach to the whole church. Women cannot be elders. Women cannot be deacons and I know that, yes, there's a deaconess. But that deaconess is a word that can mean merely the idea of a servant. And when you look at the qualifications for deacons, let deacons be husbands of one wife. Now those are the stipulations. I don't see how a woman could do that. How she could be the husband of one wife. And there is no passage that says, now, for your deaconesses, she must be the wife of one husband. She must have done this and that and the other. You don't have that. So in the sense that deacons are referred to in 1 Timothy chapter 3, a woman cannot be a deacon. Women cannot teach a class of men. Women cannot team teach with their husbands if they are going to do the teaching. I would raise grave doubts in my mind about the propriety of that. A man cannot sit in a class taught by a woman. I believe that if you do, you're causing her to violate what the Bible teaches in these passages. Now, these thoughts are not matters of custom. They're not matters of a certain period of history. Though before God, women stand on an equal footing with men in this world, God has ordained that they be subject to men, both in the church and in the home. I know that I've mentioned several issues and dealt with several issues involved, but I could not deal with all of them. And one of the reasons why I could not is time. Another one is because it is possible for us to get so fixated on some particular angle, some particular issue, well, what about this? Well, what about that? That we forget that the overall point that is being made by the Apostle Paul is that women cannot exercise the role of men in public teaching in the Lord's church. And ultimately, I think that's where we're headed if we don't respect what God's Word says and if we don't deal with it. And that's what I've been emphasizing in our lesson today. I appreciate your being here, and I surely appreciate your attention. And I hope you appreciate the effort that I have made to present this as fully and fairly as I could do. If you're not a Christian, we plead with you at this time to become one by believing that Jesus is the Son of God, turning away from sin, confessing your faith, being baptized to have your sins removed. If you're a Christian but you have turned away from God, why not repent and pray and be restored to God's grace? So whatever your circumstance, if we can assist you, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.